Hello, you're about to listen to an interview that I recorded with Pak Hang Wong, a philosopher based at the University of Hamburg in Germany. This interview starts off talking about the robotic disruption of morality, in particular how the rise of the robots could undermine our capacity to develop moral virtues, but it then develops and progresses into what I think is a really interesting discussion of Confucian ethics and how it applies to technology. This is not something that I knew very much about before talking to Pak, so it was good for me to get a kind of masterclass from him on the Confucian approach. Before we begin that interview, though, I just want to make a couple of quick announcements. Obviously, we're heading up towards the Christmas break now, so it would be remiss of me not to engage in a little bit of shameless self-promotion of the book that I published this year, Automation and Utopia, which would no doubt make a wonderful stocking filler for anyone who's worried about losing their jobs to a robot. Also, in addition to that, I just wanted to point out that I'm going to be in London on the 11th of January talking to the London Futurist Group in Birkbeck College. And if you're around the London area on those dates, it would be great if you could come out and attend that talk. Okay, without any further ado, let's move into the interview that I did with Dr. Pak Hang Wong. Okay, so my guest today is Dr. Pak Hang Wong. Pak is a philosopher of technology and works on ethical and political issues of emerging technologies. He is currently a research associate at the Universität Hamburg. He received his PhD in philosophy from the University of Twente in the Netherlands in 2012, and he then held academic positions in Oxford and Hong Kong. In 2017, he joined the Research Group for Ethics and Information Technology at the Department of Informatics in the Universität Hamburg. So welcome to the show, Pak.
Thank you for having me, John.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about the robotic disruption of morality. All right, so as we all know, robots are becoming more prevalent in our social and professional lives. And as they continue to proliferate, they will change how we act and how we relate to one another. As we come to rely upon them and have to coordinate more of our actions with them, we can expect this to affect our social norms and practices, which is likely in turn to have a disruptive impact on our moral lives. Now, you recently wrote an article examining this phenomenon, entitled Rituals and Machines, A Confucian Response to Technology-Driven Moral De-skilling. This article focuses specifically on how robots might disrupt our capacity to develop a virtuous moral character. And so we're going to be talking about some of the key arguments and ideas from this article. So let me just start by asking you an obvious question, which is, you know, what are robots and how do you think they might disrupt our moral lives? You know, I mentioned this in my introductory remarks there, but perhaps you could give us a more precise characterization of the kind of disruption we can expect.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in my articles, I used the term robots and also I used the term smart machines. I used the term rather liberally in my discussions just to refer to any technological device that are capable of acting and making decisions on their own, so autonomously. For me, these robots and smart device or smart machines could be either physical devices or virtual devices. So there are many ways in which they can disrupt our moral life. But since I'm inclined towards an ethical views that focus on human relationships, I would say, well, the mere fact that they substitute or replace human beings is already disruptive enough. So think, for example, if we replace human teachers with robot teachers, unless it is possible to recreate the experience of teaching and learning for students and teachers entirely, I think it would already be bad for students and for teachers as they do not interact in the same way with robot and human teacher in that case. When other examples I have in the paper is like smart home device like Google Home and Alexa. Well, we can just say Alexa, play, let's say Baby Shark or something like that. It changed the manner, I mean, like literally our manner in which we interact with different things, including human beings. So in that sense, I think it would have some kind of disruptions to the way we live our life. But I should add 3 points here, I think. First, by moral life, I think I would understand and interpret that rather broadly, not only us acting, let's say, more in a morally right way, but rather in a morally good life. So it's a broader understanding of what morality consists of. Second point I want to say is robots are not all that bad or always disruptive in the negative sense. There is, of course, uses of robots that can have positive impacts on our moral life. So I don't want to sound like super anti-technology here. And the third point perhaps is that it is not only the case robot that will lead to disruptions, but other technology as well. But I think robot, especially robot that are capable to act autonomously, is particularly problematic insofar as they are more capable of replacing human beings than other technological devices. So that would be the basic ideas.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be two things at play here that I wanted to maybe pick up on. So The first point is that what makes them disruptive in part is their autonomy. And I think that's fair enough because they're, in a sense, replacing what would ordinarily be done by, let's say, another human agent. That seems to be the basic rationale for introducing an autonomous robot or autonomous smart device into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I guess sometimes they can do things that no human would ever have been able to do, so that's another point here. But there's a second point in your comments, particularly, let's say, in the teacher example, which is that when they replace a human agent, they don't do it in the same way. So, like, unless the robot is some kind of perfect humanoid android, it's going to be a different relational being, in a sense. And it's this differential nature of the robot that is the thing that's disruptive. That's correct, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. Yes. And so another point, which we might pick up on later, is that when it comes to, let's say, the world of social robots, I think what's particularly interesting there is that they're often designed to somehow conjure up the memory or to be anthropomorphic in some way, so to make us think that they are human-like in certain respects, and that might cause some kind of moral confusion in addition to, let's say, disruption itself, mm-hmm. right? Okay, so, I mean, we can kind of pick up on some of these issues as the conversation progresses. So, I mean, as you say, look, moral life is a very broad concept, and the notion of moral disruption is also a very broad concept, but in your paper, you focus specifically on the phenomenon of moral de-skilling, at least initially. So could you explain what moral de-skilling is and how it might arise?
So I refer to this idea of moral de-skilling proposed or discussed in more detail by Shannon Vallas in her discussions on the relations between technologies and virtue cultivations. So basically, she borrowed the term de-skilling from economics, which basically is about like how machine automations result in certain set of skills being devalued. So just to give an example, consider the case of industrializations of productions of goods. Let's say productions of a wooden spoon. To carve a wooden spoon require a number of skills to be able to choose the right kind of wood, to cut the wood in the right shape, and so on and so forth. With automations, with automatic productions process, in that case, I think if machines can produce wooden spoon, well, more easily, more effectively, and the product is not as bad, then the skills of productions would be useless, at least in human beings, and irrelevant. So in that case, there is a kind of de-skilling going on. For Vela, this lines of arguments can actually apply to moral skills as well. So when robots substitute or replace human beings, they render some of the moral skills useless or irrelevant. So that's the basic idea of moral de-skilling, I guess. With replacement of human beings by machines, by technologies, we no longer need to perform some of the skills, some of the moral skills that are required. We no longer need that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think the analogy with industrialization and automation is a fairly clear one, in that machine labor essentially replaces skilled human labor. But applying this to the moral realm, you know, Valor has a discussion of care robotics, and you focus on this example a lot in your paper as well. So maybe you could talk a bit about the kinds of moral de-skilling that might arise if we come to rely heavily upon robots to perform care work.
Mm-hmm. So Valor, I think rightly point out that caring, especially in the healthcare context, is a combination of skills. For example, the skill of, well, appropriately touching the patient, the skill of conversations, and so on. So her worry basically is this: when we introduce robot caregivers, and when they take over this various caring duties of care workers, caretakers, or caregivers, actually, and more generally, the care duties of us, so basically as family members and friends of the patients, we no longer need to perform those acts. So we no longer really need to touch the patients. We no longer really need to talk to the patient in that sense, because the robot is doing all the job. So when we let the robot caregivers carry the patients, when we let them listen and respond to them, in this way, she argues the opportunity to touch, to talk, are taken away by the robot. And those skills become useless, or at least irrelevant for human beings, because then robots can actually complete the tasks better, faster, more efficient. And in that case, human beings would also lack the opportunity to use and practice those skills in the, at least in the healthcare context.
Yeah, I mean, there's an issue with that kind of argument that I think I want to come back to maybe after we discuss some of your other kind of complications to Valor's argument. But I mean, basically, I think the phenomenon or the worry here is relatively easy to grasp, and that's so far as like developing the ability to care for another person that cultivate certain moral virtues, and if you're getting a machine to do that, you're no longer developing that skill of moral caring, let's say. Now, one of the things you point out in the article, which I think really kind of one of the key interesting bits of your article, is that Valor's argument is limited because it focuses on one particular way in which we build virtues, or one theory of how we build virtues, when there are in fact a number of different theories of how we acquire and develop virtues. So what are these different theories?
So, well, the basic idea is that when I read Valor's arguments, her arguments just look into this specific way of, like you said, virtue building. So there are in other areas of philosophy, philosophy of virtue cultivations, philosophy about virtue cultivations, and moral psychologies, they have talked about different ways in which individuals could actually acquire virtues. So I look into philosopher Nancy Schnoh's recent work, which very helpfully identified three paradigms or model of virtue developments. And they are the folk paradigm, the skills and expertise paradigms, and the Confucian paradigm, which I focus in my articles.
Right. And so, I mean, this is kind of the key aspect of your work, is the development of this Confucian model. But we'll get there in a minute. So let me talk first about this folk model of virtue acquisition or virtue building. Like, what is this model? And I mean, I have a couple of questions here. Like, one is, like, how does it differentiate from the skill building model that Valor talks about?
So I'll just explain what that model is and then try to see whether I can really well distinguish the folk model from the skill and expertise models. So in the folk model, basically the idea is that virtues are acquired indirectly as a byproduct of individuals' fulfillment of certain role or certain aspirations or attainment of their goal, basically. So just to give you an example to explain that, if I aspire to be a fireman, let's say, I would need to become brave along the way when I train to be a good fireman, because courage would be required in order to be a good, well, fireman. So the basic idea then is, well, if I want to be in a particular role, it would indirectly equip me with some type of virtue in which to achieve that role would require. So this is different from the skill model, to the extent that in the skill models, the acquisition of virtue is conscious and deliberate. So basically, we need to act actively to acquire the virtue. It's more like acquisition of skills in that sense. So if I want to learn tennis, then I need to actually do something to play tennis. But not so much in the folk model.
Right. I mean, like, the way in which I think about this, maybe part of the reason why I don't know if I fully buy the idea that there are two distinct models here, is that I would imagine that in most cases, there's probably a combination of both things going on. So, I mean, just to give an illustration, let's say I'm a teacher and I want to be a good teacher, a virtuous teacher. No doubt, like, occupying that role and trying to fulfill that goal just through kind of repetitive, constantly teaching and repeating it over and over again, and maybe indirectly learning from other people or acquiring models from other people, I'm sure I'll build some sense of what the virtues of teaching are and some skills around that. But then maybe part of it will also be a deliberate skill building exercise. In the same way that, let's say, tennis playing, part of that will be through deliberate conscious training, but also part of it will be just like playing lots of games that'll help me to become a good tennis player. So I'd imagine that in most cases there's a bit of both going on.
Right. But I would argue actually that in the folk model, you don't really have to be conscious of you are acquiring virtues. So the basic idea would be, I guess, if you become a teacher, or if you want to become a teacher, you don't necessarily have to consciously, well, acquire the virtue of or relate to teaching, but you can just teach and teach and teach, and then somehow you build up this skill set and set of virtues that you have without really taking the conscious effort to do that. Perhaps a related question or related difference between the two models would be, at least in one understanding of the skill models, the person who is virtuous need to be able to articulate what counts as virtues. So the person need to be able to explain what that virtue is. So that makes a difference for the folk model, in which case many of those people would not be able to explain why that is virtuous and what to do to be virtuous.
Yeah, actually, you know, this kind of reminds me of a debate in economic theory as well. And there's a famous sociologist, Michael Polanyi, wrote this book about tacit knowledge, or the tacit dimension. So this notion that many skills are kind of tacit, that we aren't able to consciously articulate the rules underlying the practices themselves. So I guess the folk model is a bit like that, in that the way in which we acquire and develop the virtue of being a good teacher is tacit. It's just something learned through the practice itself. Whereas with the skill building model, it's something that can be articulated into a set of rules. So we see this, interestingly, Valor developed this by analogy with the economic realm. We see the analogy applying more broadly to the folk model as well, that there are certain skills that are developed in this tacit way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before we move on to the Confucian argument, though, I just want to dwell on a couple of issues with the folk model and the skill model. So we outlined Valor's argument earlier on about how the use of robotics, such as care robots, will disrupt or de-skill us. Can robots disrupt and undermine the folk model of a virtue acquisition as well? And is it just effectively the same thing because they replace us in different roles, or is there something different going on?
The problem with the folk model basically is that precisely because if we want to be virtuous, we need to perform some role. Unless we can argue for the values of those roles or intrinsic values of those roles. In fact, it seems that when the technology would be able to play those roles, then that folk model would not work anymore. So just to use the examples again, if fireman is not available, or that particular role is not available, not valuable, or not relevant anymore, since, let's say, fireman could just push a few buttons and then the robot will do the job, then, I mean, the folk model loses its meaning entirely.
Right. So you're not, because you're not really doing anything. You're not participating in the role anymore. Or the role has fundamentally changed in some sense.
I guess
is probably the better way of describing this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this brings me to another point as well about, you know, this assumption underlying this discussion is that there's something bad about this, that if machines replace us in certain roles, we're denied the opportunity to acquire virtues, either passively through the indirect folk model or actively and consciously through the skill model. But this brings to mind, you know, an analogous debate again in economic theory about automation in the workplace, which is that, okay, sure, machines will replace us in some roles, in some tasks, but humans will find other kinds of jobs to migrate into. So is it really such a bad thing if robots replace us in performing certain roles and deny us the opportunity to develop certain skills? Isn't this okay as long as we have the opportunity to develop other kinds of virtues or other kinds of skills?
I guess it is very much an empirical matter in that case. So we need to know actually what is required in the world and how is it to live a good life or a moral life, so to speak. But in an important sense, if we take, let's say, some roles as important, as valuable, then it seems that when we replace those roles with machines and robots, it becomes morally problematic. It is especially problematic, as I'll try to say a bit more, in the case of Confucian philosophy or Confucian ethics, because role plays a very important role.
Yeah, I suppose, like as you say, it's partly an empirical matter here as to exactly which roles they fulfill and which roles they perform. You know, I think there's a question to be asked here as to how problematic it is, depending exactly on the use cases to which we put robots. You know, like again, in the economic sphere, you know, some people would say it's a good thing because they will be given better opportunities to develop virtues. But I guess that's something that we need to work out and practice. Let's move on then to discuss the Confucian model. So look, I'll have to confess that I don't really know anything about Confucian ethics, or I know very little about Confucian ethics, and I know that this is, you know, one of your kind of specialist topics or areas, so maybe you could educate me a bit about the distinctive Confucian approach to ethics and virtues in particular. How does it work?
Right, so I'm going to stick with Nancy Snow's idea of Confucian paradigm here, because for different reasons, of course, Confucian ethics has been interpreted very differently for different philosophers and scholars. So it would be easier and safer to stick with her characterizations, so to speak. So in her discussions, basically the Confucian model is to describe a way to cultivate virtues. And virtue cultivation is considered as a structured immersion into a particular way of life, which is characterized by a set of Confucian values, which include, for example, virtue of benevolence, or some people would translate that as humanness, virtue of righteousness. And important to this Confucian model would be, it's not enough to have these virtues internally, so to speak, but you need to practice certain rituals in order to express that you have such virtue in you. And in doing so, you need to pay attention not just to what you do, but also how you perform certain tasks. So one important way to express that is, it is not just important to think about what we do, but also how we do it. Let's say we can communicate with friends, family, parents, so on and so forth. But it's not just important to communicate, talk to them, but rather you have to talk to them in a specific, respectful manner. So this would be kind of what is special about Confucian ethics. So there are a few things about Confucian ethics that worth mentioning. First would be, Confucian ethics is, in an important sense, perfectionist, because there is a specific set of values in which people should aspire to develop. It is holistic in the sense that when we try to talk about virtue development, it's not compartmentalized into different things. So it's like the way of living is important for virtue development. It is also about both ethics and aesthetics, insofar as external performance or performance bodily expression matters. And I would also add that while there are, like I said, different interpretations of Confucian ethics, one lines would often align with Aristotelian virtue ethics, and other lines of argument would be to think of Confucian ethics as a type of role ethics, where performance of role responsibility take the central place.
All right, so I mean, there's a number of things that I'm kind of interested in picking up on here. Mm-hmm. From what I recall in Shannon Valor's book, and I interviewed her previously on this podcast, she does talk a bit about the Confucian ethical model. She talks about, you know, Western and Eastern traditions in virtue ethics. and kind of similarities between them. So maybe you could talk a bit to the similarities and differences between the kind of Confucian model and the, I guess, the more European traditional model. I mean, just to point out one thing that you pick up on in the article is the, I guess, the individualism element of it as being a key difference. So maybe you could talk about that distinction between them.
So to start with the idea of individualism, I think Joel Kupperman basically argued that in the case of Aristotelian virtue ethics, it's still very much individualist to the extent that it is about that person developing their virtue, even though you can say there is the virtue of friendship that you need to develop alongside with others. But very much the focus is still on that particular individual's doing things to others, so to speak. For Confucian ethics, I would argue that they have a different understanding of personhood or the self, which is fundamentally relational, social, and developmental. So by relational, it basically means, well, we have all this relational ethics right now that individuals are always related to others. Social in the sense that for Confucian ideas, a person is always situated in a particular social context. Especially for Confucianism, this idea is that, well, we are situated in a familial context, that we are always someone's son, sometimes someone's father, so on and so forth. It is developmental in the sense that, well, it's interesting that for Confucianism, to be a human, you have to earn to be a human. So you are not just born as a human being, but rather you develop into human beings by performing certain virtues, by developing your, performing certain rituals and developing your virtues. So that would be one of the major differences between Aristotelian virtue ethics and Confucian virtue ethics, so to speak. But I would take it further and argue that actually Confucian could be understood as a role ethics in which the fundamental normativities come from one's role, not really from, well, human nature.
Okay, I mean, so again, there's lots of things that I want to maybe just burrow into it in a bit more detail on that. So, I mean, one aspect of that, the self is not something that can be defined in the abstract or atomistically. Who you are is constituted and defined by the role that you perform in society, or the roles that you perform in society, and the relationships that you have with others. That's sort of the key aspect of the relational theory, right?
Right.
Right. And then this idea of you become human through activity, like, on the face of it, this sounds very different to the tradition that's emerged in, let's say, in Europe in the 20th century through, like, the post-war era, this notion of kind of universal human dignity that everyone has from birth. Am I picking up that there's a distinctive concept in the Confucian tradition, or is that not the correct contrast to draw?
Well, it is also subject to debate, I guess. Well, there are discussions as to, in the case of Confucianism, in the case of Mencius, they are still something fundamentally the same for all human beings, that they are capable to become a sage or become a, well, paradigmic person. So in that case, they are similar, but I think what is special about Confucianism is that these things, although everyone would have it, nonetheless, you need to really develop it in order to become a person.
Okay, so there is some kind of maybe basic humanness that everyone shares, but then there's a higher level to be attained through practice. Okay, and then and the other thing that you mentioned that I wanted to pick up on was this sense that virtue is attached to the role. So this suggests that, so there is no general abstract theory or model of virtue that derives from our humanness. There is rather a context-specific or highly situational model of virtues at play in the Confucian model. Is that correct?
I would say so. Well, so the focus is basically on what you perform as some roles within a particular relational context. So if I am a son of someone, then it is my duty to perform the role of a son and in relation to that particular familial context.
So this is a question I was going to ask you earlier, but this, I think it ties in nicely to this idea, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with Alistair MacIntyre's theory of virtue and the good life. And I, you know, I'm not an expert on it, but like one of the things that he kind of develops is this radical pluralism about virtues and the good life. Like, this isn't entirely fair to what he says, but this is an element of what he says, which is that, you know, every activity has its own internal goods associated with it. And then there's a way of being virtuous in performing that activity. It's a kind of disposition to act for the good within that activity. So, I mean, to make that like a little bit less abstract, he might say something like there's a way of playing chess that is good. There are internal goods associated with chess playing, like strategic playing and decisiveness and courageousness and decision making, let's say, that are, they're tied to that specific practice. You can't really define them in the abstract. They have to be linked to the practice itself. And this kind of means that any practice has its own set of virtues and goods, so that you can kind of do anything in a virtuous way and have there's a good way of doing it. Is the Confucian tradition distinct from that? Is it that there are a limited set of practices that have goods and virtues associated with them? Or does it endorse a more pluralistic approach to virtue and the good life?
Right. So I think for Confucianism, there would be definitely be a limit as to which role would be a good role and which would not. In the case of MacIntyre, I guess, there's also a related questions in the context of Taoisms, whether you can be a virtuous murderer by being, practice very well the skill of murdering peoples. So that would be the similar case as in the case of MacIntyre, whether you can have a practice like that, but inherently immorals. So I guess in the case of Confucianism, they have some limit just to stop that from happening. And very often they refer to existing role relations, like, for example, father and son, friends, husband and wife, so on and so forth. So this gives at least some limits as to how and where this goodness can come from, instead of just everywhere and anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if... I don't think MacIntyre would endorse the completely radical pluralism about it. I think there might be some basic ethical constraints in his theory. So it mightn't be possible to be a virtuous murderer, let's say. His theory is complex, so I don't think I can do justice to it in my comments. But I think there is that pluralistic element to it. But, I mean, this also raises another question. Like, my limited impression of Confucianism and discussions about it is that it's a highly conservative model of virtue and ethics. And this kind of comes out in that comment that you just made, that a lot of the discussion and focus is on traditional roles. And actually, as far as I recall, this is one of the critiques that Valor has of a lot of traditional virtue ethic models, is that they're tied to a particular life world, let's say, and it's difficult for them to make sense in the modern technological era. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Definitely. I think Valor is right to concern about that. But also, if we think of this way, then tradition is more like a static, stable concept, in which I probably would disagree. So for me, even if we talked about tradition, it is a living concept that we can draw from. And even in Confucianism, it very much, although it also stresses on the fact that we shouldn't change rituals just randomly or just arbitrarily, but nevertheless, they allow room for first changing the rituals. Second, they also allow rooms for creative performance of existing rituals. So yes and no, I guess, that we actually could accommodate technological changes if we take into consideration technologies actually in performing rituals.
Right. And this is, I guess, one of the things that you're doing through a lot of your work, is that you're applying the Confucian model to these debates about technology. But there's a key element of the Confucian model, which you've mentioned several times, but I think we need to go into in a bit more detail now, which is the role of rituals in Confucian virtue ethics. What are rituals, and how exactly do they help in the process of virtue building or virtue acquisition? And, you know, it would probably be helpful if we could give an example, I guess, of a Confucian ritual.
Right. So regions are important to the extent that they are, well, they capture the idea of role responsibility in Confucian ethics. Regions are considered to be expressions of role responsibility, or to put it otherwise, it specifies what appropriate ways to for one to fulfill their role responsibilities. I should also add that rituals in Confucianism are not necessarily formal or official rituals, as in the case of many Christians' rituals or Christian understanding of rituals. It can be just about everyday mundane stuff. So, for example, in the Analects, one of the classics in Confucian philosophy, it kind of famously documents different ways in which Confucius or Kongzi of doing mundane things, such as sitting, eating, and greetings with others. The most famous examples of Confucian rituals probably would be funerals and mourning exercise, where children or offspring are supposed to have a three-year period of mourning and wear specific clothing in the funerals and all the settings. So the basic idea for Confucianism is by performing this type of rituals, it helps individuals to express and display their attitudes by having this particular behavior displayed in the public and to make kind of internal and external consistency within an individual. And also a kind of consistency with the accepted social and political norms or normative standards. So in the case of funeral, it would demonstrate a way to grieve in consistent with the public understanding of what grief is supposed to be. So through performance of this exercise, the person would be able to attune their internal emotions and behavior, as well as their internal state with what is being socially accepted and politically accepted.
Right. So I mean, this kind of ties then to the aesthetic aspect of Confucianism. Is that right? I mean, if I could put it very glibly, and this might be unfair, there's a kind of like a fake it till you make it element to this, and that like you perform the ritual over and over again, and then through that process, through some kind of osmosis, you will develop the virtue. Or is that wrong? Is that me importing a Western or Aristotelian model of virtue, let's say, into the Confucian tradition, where I'm thinking that to develop a virtue, it has to be some kind of internal disposition or state, whereas in the Confucian approach, that's not really the right way to think about virtues at all?
Yes, I think it's part of the truth that, well, you need to fake it until you make it. But I guess the difference between the Confucian versions and the Aristotelian version of virtue ethics or role ethics is one that they really stress on the expression and display of attitudes. Part of the reason is that it is only through this public display. It captures the social and political dimension of virtue, I suppose, because otherwise you can say whatever that you have internally developed, but nonetheless, no one can really know whether you have virtues or not.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I'm quite sympathetic to that idea that in a sense, like, actions speak louder than alleged internal states when it comes to virtue. So yeah, I mean, I think the framing it in terms of a fake it till you make it model is unfair to what's actually going on here. But that was just a thought that kind of came into my head when you were discussing it. Let me ask you this. Like, is it fair to say that what rituals do then is that they provide a kind of forum, a repetitive forum in which we develop virtues? And is the hope that through performing the rituals, we will develop a virtuous character that spills over into other aspects of our lives? So it's not just something that is confined to the ritual itself.
Right. So, but I would add that this space that is provided by ritual is not just a very thin or shallow concept, but rather it's very thick in the sense that in this space, you have all this emotional experience. So it's more like a reenactment of the entire experience than just to have fun in the space and to play certain roles. So it's not really playing, but you immerse in this role that you have when performing rituals.
Okay. So yeah, it's not a trivial thing. It's a very thick and important concept and space and phenomenon within the Confucian tradition.
Right.
Right. So let's bring all this back around to the problem of moral de-skilling. So how can we develop a kind of Confucian response to the problem of moral de-skilling? Actually, let me back up for a minute, because maybe that's not the question I want to ask first. Because the question I asked about the other two models of virtue acquisition, the skill model and the folk model, was how does the rise of the robot, so to speak, disrupt virtues? How does it disrupt virtue in the case of the Confucian approach?
So in the case of Confucian model, basically the idea is not so much it disrupts the opportunity to perform a particular skills or assuming a particular role. But basically the idea is that in the case of technology-driven moral de-skilling, it is the whole activities being at stake, or the whole meanings of, let's say, in the case of caring, the idea of caring, the way to perform caring, that is being at stake. So you can still have care, as you can still have this opportunity to perform care, but the way to do it would be rather different if we introduce robots into the mix. So that is what Confucian paradigms concern with, I guess.
Right. So, I mean, how would it be different? I mean, if you thought about the example of the care robot, so what's the problem there?
So Confucian paradigm would require thinking about the way in which, let's say, robot caregiver would take over the task of caring or not. Also, they would, of course, care about whether individuals would have opportunity to care for others or not, just like in the case of the skill model as suggested by Valas. But the difference would be very much for Confucianism. The problem would be for the robot to take over the task of care in terms of the skills, or not the skills, the rituals of care. So people no longer care about care, no longer care about how to care with others and specific way in which we care about others in the societies and in the communities. So it's more like the matters about performance of specific things within the care context and specific attitudes that we displace in that particular context.
But could you give an example of like the kinds of things that we're performing in the care role that could be it could be problematic for robots to be taking over from this perspective?
Right. So I guess to put it this way, it would be more or less the same as in the case of Valas to say if we introduce care robots into the mix, basically people would have less chance to care for others if we replace human beings with robots. In the case of Confucians, their interpretations would not be people would not have opportunity to do that, but rather it changed the way in which we care about people and in a way that does not match with how we think about care. So just to give an example, perhaps we take touching as important as a specific way of touching, let's say patting someone's head as important actions in the case of care. With robots, with the introductions of robots, then it takes away this particular way of expressing care in the community. And that is what concerns Confucianism in the sense that it's not really about individuals' skills that matter, but very much the way in which that community expresses care that matter. So this would be the part about rituals, not just about skills of individuals.
Okay, so like this is where, so like when I read your paper, I think I interpreted it in a slightly different way. So what I thought was going on was that there are certain rituals of care, let's say, like touching people and expressing care for them through that physical contact, that have a kind of central importance in our moral lives. And so, again, partly for the aesthetic reasons, for the social meaning attached to them and so forth. And the problem is with robots replacing or performance of those tasks is that they disrupt this kind of centrally important ritual. Was that an incorrect interpretation of what was going on?
No. I think you are correct to say that. But what I'm saying, I don't think what I have said differs from what you have said so much, actually. So aesthetic dimensions would be important, but also important is the way in which that ritual of care is being performed or not performed with the introductions of robots.
Right. So I mean, because the reason I'm asking this is it kind of links back to my earlier criticism or concern about the skill model or the folk model, which is that, okay, look, we lose these opportunities for developing virtues, but we'll gain others, or we'll have other things that we can do where we can build virtues. But I thought, like, so what's distinctive about the Confucian approach, at least as I understood it, was that there are certain things that have this importance and social meaning that it's a bad thing for us to be replaced in the performance of those roles, because it has these much kind of broader consequences, because it undermines or corrupts a significant moral ritual. Is that the wrong, or is that the way to interpret it? I'm not sure.
I think it is the way I actually interpret it. Maybe my example is not as good as what you have said, but yes, you are right to characterize Confucianism's or Confucian ethics in that case this way.
Right. So I mean, this suggests to me that we should be particularly concerned about certain forms of automation and certain forms of robotic activity, right?
Right, yes.
Not necessarily because they deny us opportunities for skill building, but because there's a symbolic significance to certain activities, right?
Right, but I would just add that it's not just about symbolic, but rather rituals basically define the way in which people should interact within the communities. So once you take that away, it has social and political repercussions. So not just symbolic, but very much a communicative matter as well. So the way I would explain that would be, in that case, you take away a particular way of saying things. You take away a particular way of communicating with the communities. So this would be bad insofar as that way of communicating, that language, if you will, is important to the community.
All right. I mean, how does this idea generalize then, like, to this thinking in Confucian terms, to this phenomenon, these concerns about automation and AI? We've spoken a lot about the example of care robotics, let's say, but I mean, more generally, how does it apply?
Right. So as a philosopher, I don't really have concrete examples. So we talked about, like, care robots, but I didn't really talk about how to design or how to implement robots in the care context. I guess what I would say in that particular paper, or at least what I was trying to do in that paper, is simply to point out that this kind of discussions cannot be limited to individuals. And that if we take rituals seriously, then what we need to think about is rituals as a normative guidelines or foundations for thinking about design and applications of robots. So in that case, I think we need to study rituals and traditions as normative resources for us to think, to consider applications of robots, not just in the care context, but also, let's say, in the teaching, learning context, and other friendship and, let's say, medical context as well.
I guess this also links to another question, which is to come at this topic from a different perspective. And this is something you do touch upon in the paper, which is that the assumption throughout our conversation is that there's some impact of robots on humans, and we've got to care about human virtues and the roles that humans perform, that they allow the opportunity to develop virtues, or that we maintain these important rituals of virtue. But there's another perspective on this as well, which you just touched upon, which is the design of the robots themselves to make them virtuous in a sense. I mean, like, this is the way I interpreted one of the discussions in the article, where you look at the work of, is it Ji Lu Liu? I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation. So it seems to me that she is developing a kind of theory of machine ethics that is modeled on Confucian virtues, that robots have to be virtuous in the way in which they're performing their roles. Is that another way in which you can apply this Confucian paradigm?
Right. So one way, her way to do that is actually trying to mimic the three law of robotics and to put the Confucian elements in it. And that would be one thing. Also, I would think that Well, if virtue is not virtue, if rituals is really fundamentally important as a normative resources, then we can also refer to rituals as a set of guidelines in design technology that proactively change human behavior to fit rituals and to become virtuous.
To go back to another point about, you know, moral traditions developing, are there new rituals that we should be developing in relation to technologies as well? I mean, what I mean here is that so technologies afford us the possibility of new kinds of action and new kinds of relationship. And should we be thinking in Confucian terms about, yeah, developing new rituals associated with those technologies? Or is that just basically the point you were trying to make there?
Well, yes, that's the point that I'm trying to make. Definitely we should think about new rituals, but I guess the basic assumption would be the same. We need to look into existing rituals and to match that with the technology that we have and to think of how this technology could help us to realize the rituals. Very often I use these examples. If we design a robot and we want people to interact rather in a polite manner, then probably we should give them eyes and give them like facial expressions, which would help people to, well, be more polite, so to speak, when they see people's, well, when they see robots have this face and facial expressions.
All right, that's quite interesting. And that ties to some extent to the kind of aesthetic aspects of,
right,
of moral
exactly.
performance as well. Yeah. So this is interesting to me because it's a reason for some kinds of anthropomorphization in social robotics. A lot of people
right.
are resistant to it, but this is an argument for favoring it because it actually helps with virtue building. Whereas,
right.
I think you mentioned this at the very start of the conversation, if you have something like Alexa, which is just this, you know, tube, black tube or disc that sits on your table, you can be quite impolite to that because it's just a thing, it's just an object. Even though there is some kind of social interaction with it because it has a voice interface, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so I mean, I think that's an important idea about thinking about the design of technologies in these Confucian terms, and this is one of the things that the Confucian paradigm can kind of shed light on, is thinking about the design of ethical technologies in a different way.
Right. I guess what makes Confucian ethics special would be in the case of, at least right now, in philosophy of technology and in ethics of technology, no one really pay much attention to the aesthetic dimensions of technologies in design. But if we take ritual seriously, if we take the expressions of behavior seriously, then we need to take into considerations of that as well. So that would be something new, I guess, Confucian ethics could also supply to the current discussions.
Yeah, no, I like this idea a lot because I think it also just coheres with some of my own thoughts about the importance
right.
of kind of behavioral dimension in ethics as opposed to just a purely internal cognitive dimension to this. So yeah, I think there's an interesting analogy or a connection between these, some of the ideas that I've been developing, not adopting a Confucian paradigm, and this Confucian paradigm as you've set it out here. So I think it's probably incumbent upon me to learn more about this and think about it in a bit more detail. Okay, so thanks very much for joining me for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.